Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Douglas Rushkoff is a well-known media critic and documentarian, the author of 10 books. Rushkoff's new one is called Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation and How to Take It Back. He opens the book with an anecdote about something that happened a couple of years ago, as he told Steve Paulson.
I was renting in a neighborhood that I couldn't quite afford and hoping to buy, and everyone was telling me to just man up and take an $800,000 mortgage and get a million-dollar house. And I was pining over all this as I was taking out my garbage on Christmas Eve, and a guy came up and mugged me with a gun. And I posted about what had happened on something called the Park Slope Parents List, this really kind of lefty, crunchy breastfeeding strategies for fellow parents, kind of a mailing list. I said what had happened. You know, I was on 7th Street and I got mugged. And the first two responses I got within an hour of having gotten mugged, and this is on Christmas Eve, were from homeowners angry that I had posted the location where I had gotten mugged because this could negatively affect their property values.
Wow. No sympathy at all for the fact that
you'd
been mugged.
Well, one of them said, "I'm sorry you got mugged, but do you realize what it does to property values?" And I realized these people were more concerned about the short-term asset value of their property than they were the long-term experiential value of their neighborhood. What I realized was that the problem was not just that there are these big corporations out there, that there's a second Starbucks on the block. The problem is that people have internalized the values of corporations and replaced human values with these corporate metrics.
I think we need to back up for a moment. When you talk about corporatism, what do you mean?
I was looking at the history of corporations and realized that corporations are not this sort of anti-government entity the way we think about them, like there's the market on one side and the government on the other, that corporations are a government-created entity, that corporatism was really a system that was invented really as far back as the late Middle Ages by monarchs who were looking for a way to stay powerful in the face of a rising merchant class. And what they did was really made commerce for people illegal and said, instead, everything's going to have to be run through these state-chartered corporations, British East India Trading Company, things like that.
So the implicit deal was that a certain powerful group of people had a monopoly on the commerce in a particular area, and this was sanctioned by the government, and the government got revenue from it.
Exactly. You know, the merchants were in competition with each other. So if you get picked by the king to be the exclusive purveyor of cotton or the exclusive company in charge of the West Indies, that's a good deal. And you're willing to pay 10 or 20% of your revenue to the king or to allow investment by the aristocrats. And meanwhile, the aristocrats who were basically landlocked, who didn't have any way of creating value themselves, an aristocracy that only had money and nothing else, now had a way to invest that money in order to make money rather than doing something to make money, sort of the old-fashioned labor way.
Well, you're really talking about the rise of capitalism, and yet when we think of that happening, we think about competition.
What? The funny thing is to see that, well, even though we live in a world now where corporations are free to compete with each other on a certain level, you know, you've got, you know, GE competes with Westinghouse or Ford competes with GM. I mean, there's some competition between corporations. There's no competition against corporations themselves. In other words, when recent example is the the toy paint manufacturing scandal, where all these conglomerates outsourced their toy manufacturing to China and a bunch of toys came back with this lead-tainted paint. So we create, you know, government comes in and says, okay, we're going to create great regulations to prevent lead paint from ever getting in children's mouths again. And what that is a testing procedure. So it costs maybe $50,000 or $60,000 for a toy company to test a toy before they can put it out on the market. Well, what does that do to the small toy manufacturer, to the company that's making 100 of something rather than 100,000 of something? They can't spend $50,000 per toy that they're manufacturing. And what it does is that it puts everyone else out of business.
Now, are you suggesting that this corporate age that we live in is to some degree responsible for our current economic crisis?
The corporate age that we're in is the current economic crisis. You know, there's no difference. You know, the economic crisis that we're in is the crisis of a debt-based economy. I mean, in one sense, when John McCain said, well, this is really psychological, you know, the economy is actually sound, in a weird way, those guys were actually right. Are there people with skills and with needs? Do we still have land on which we can grow crop? Do we still have a manufacturing base? Yeah, we still have all the things of which a real economy can be made. The problem is, we live in a virtual economy. We live in a derivative economy. We live in an economy that is fueled by debt.
You're saying in some ways we've stopped being a nation of producers. I mean, yes, we still have producers, manufacturers, and other people who actually make things, but that's not really what drives the economy anymore.
Right. Our economy is not driven by the creation of value. Our economy is driven by the creation of debt. And the object is not to actually pay back the debt by creating value. The object is to pay back the debt by getting other people to go into greater debt. And that's because our biggest business in America is banking, is speculation. The speculative economy is actually bigger than the real economy. So that means that derivatives really outweigh value creation as an economic priority. And that's why we're in trouble.
Now, you've also talked about the centralized currency that we have. I mean, the money system, which we all take for granted. I mean, is there anything else
right.
that, I mean, short of going back to the Middle Ages and, you know, bartering in the markets, is there a different
way
to do this?
There is, you know, and it's interesting because in the Middle Ages, they had something other than bartering in the markets. They had local currencies. You know, in the old days, back in the Middle Ages, before all this stuff was made illegal, you know, people used to bring grain in from the fields and they'd weigh it at the grain store and you'd get a receipt for the grain that you brought in. So if you brought in, you know, 500 pounds of grain that season, you'd get receipts for 500 pounds of grain. And then you could spend those receipts as money because everyone knew what they were actually worth. Now, when money is created through the abundance of the crop, it is no longer a necessarily scarce resource over which people are competing. It doesn't have the bias as the kind of currency that we use. And these towns, and this is why there was such a crisis in the late Middle Ages, this is why the aristocracy went nuts, is that the merchant class was getting rich. The bourgeois, what we call the middle class, was getting richer than the aristocracy because they were trading. There was so much money in these little towns through all this local currency, this abundance-based economy that they had developed. They had so much extra money that they built cathedrals. We call the late Middle Ages the age of cathedrals. And it's not because the Vatican was writing a check for them to build something. It was because there was so much extra money. They were literally investing their money in the future by investing it in real things. What the aristocracy did was said, this is crazy. We can't live in a world like this. So what did they do? They made local currency illegal. I mean, there were wars fought. People died. Blood was spilled. And they said, no, no, you all have to use coin of the realm that's going to be issued from the central treasury by the king with his picture on it. If you use anything else, we'll kill you. And this new money is going to be scarce. We're going to release it in such a way now that you all have to compete over it or pay it back to the central treasury. And it changed the way the economy works. And it's the economy that we live in today, where money is released by the Federal Reserve, where it's literally lent into existence and it has to be paid back in greater quantity than it was borrowed. And how can you pay back more money than exists in circulation? Well, by borrowing more money and so on and so on.
So are you saying that we would be better off now in the 21st century if we had local currencies, a number of local currencies rather than one centralized currency?
I'm saying we'd be better off now if we're going to live in a market society with a free market currency system as well, where people wouldn't have to use a single long-distance fiat centrally issued currency for every single thing in their lives. There are kinds of transactions between me and my CSA, my community supported agriculture group, between me and my babysitter, me and my chiropractor. There are local transactions that could be done more efficiently with local currencies, and long distance transactions will always be done more efficiently with centralized currencies.
Well, and you tell a story in your book of a local organic restaurant, I guess, near you that wasn't able to do a renovation because the bank froze its lending. And I guess members of the community came forward and contributed some money.
Yeah, well, we didn't really contribute money as much as we invested money. You know, the restaurant called Comfort, he had borrowed half the money he needed to do his renovation. Then the bank froze up. And now he's really between a rock and a hard place. He can't go forward because he doesn't have any money, and he can't go back because he owes money to the bank. So what we did was we developed something called Comfort Dollars. Invest $100, and you get $120 credit at the restaurant. So here's a restaurant that we're all going to go to anyway. I mean, there's no question that we're going to be spending our money there. We all go there. So now we get 20% return right away on our investment. And he gets the money he needs to finish his renovation faster and cheaper than he can get it from a bank. So we end up, instead of outsourcing our investment to some Wall Street firm, we can now invest locally. We can help a guy grow a real business that's a good business that actually serves people that we can see. We can improve the quality of our main street and help encourage other businesses to come in. We can have fun doing it, and we create something for ourselves.
So what can we do to reclaim our lives from this corporate society?
I think we got to think small. I think the last thing we should do is join a movement. You know, joining another great internet-branded movement is a way to distract ourselves from terra firma again. So just join community-supported agriculture instead of going to the giant corporatized supermarket chain and see what that does. You'll find out that, oh, well, the CSA is oversubscribed. Okay, they're oversubscribed, so what does that mean? They just need more land, right? Oh, what? They got this more land? Why aren't they allowed to grow on that more land? Oh, because the corn lobby has set it aside for a corn subsidy and they're not allowed to grow chard on it without paying money to the government for some. Well, what is that rule? Oh, I just want to drive my bike to work. Start with that. Well, you can't ride your bike to work because that street is a highway? Well, how can you get a bike lane? Oh, you can't get a bike lane because there's this. Well, then how do you change that? When you want to do one teeny little thing, you find out that you will come up against the obstacles that actually need to be changed. You know, I got wailed on by Newsweek that, you know, I had this whole big critique of corporatism, and then my argument for how to get away is the tiny ideas of silly, stupid things like babysitting clubs and local currencies, things that just don't work. And it's only the tiny ideas that work. It's our addiction to big ideas, our addiction to some giant movement, institutional change, march on Washington. The idea that we're dependent on Obama for a better life is itself the problem. The fact is we do have the means to care for each other, to grow food, to educate each other, to do the very basic things that people need to enrich their lives. And once you start looking for them in the smallest of ways, even something as simple as trying to set up a system through which you and your friends babysit for each other's kids, it ends up rippling out in ways that you just wouldn't believe.
Douglas Rushkoff is the author of Life, Inc., How the World Became a Corporation, and How to Take It Back. He spoke with Steve Paulson.